On Tech News Today, Tesla makes their patents open source, sort of. William Shatner negotiates a deal for Priceline, but is it a good one? Plus, Google wants to get you in shape. And Don Reisinger is my co-anchor today. We're joined by journalists from Forbes, ZDNet, Wired, 9to5Mac, and VentureBeat. Stick around. Tech News Today is coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, June 13th, 2014. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Don Reisinger.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Don Reisinger, boy, it's a big day for news. You and I have been wrestling and grappling with these stories all morning, getting ready for the show. Pretty exciting news day, I think. What do you think?
It's a pretty good day, yeah. Friday the 13th came, actually, not bad.
Full moon, you know, I mean...
Full moon, too?
Yeah, full moon. There's somebody in the chat room said that anyway. I haven't seen the moon in a few days, but who knows?
Good.
So what could go wrong?
Go out at night.
Yeah, what could go wrong? We're going to find out right now. Well, let's jump right into it. Tesla CEO Elon Musk yesterday announced an open invitation for other car companies to use Tesla patents. Pretty amazing move by the CEO of Tesla. Now, Jason Perlow is joining us. He's a columnist for ZDNet. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, good afternoon.
We also joined by Clint Finley, a reporter for Wired. Hi, Clint.
Hello.
And Eric Blatberg is a staff writer for VentureBeat, and he's with us as well. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Jason Perlow, let's be clear about what Musk is doing here. He didn't, as been falsely reported, make Tesla patents open source or even open Tesla patents to any company who wants to use them. He basically made a claim that Tesla wouldn't sue any company operating in good faith that used these patents. What do you make of this? Is this a publicity stunt that's kind of meaningless, or is this a pretty bold and amazing thing that he's doing?
No, this is actually quite significant. I mean, the term open source has been bandied about. I even use it in my own column myself. But the reality is that, you know, there's a big difference between open sourcing and agreeing not to litigate if somebody uses those patents. It also doesn't... it doesn't obviate the possibility. It doesn't remove the possibility of licensing of technologies and implementations, specifically of parts and electronics and various designs that Tesla may have to other large auto manufacturers. So essentially, what Tesla is looking for, what Elon Musk is looking for, is partners. Obviously, this is a licensing play. This is a partnership play. He has a $5 billion factory for building lithium-ion batteries that go into his cars that needs to get constructed. This is not the sort of thing that you know, he can probably do at it alone. He's probably looking for much larger pockets to do this. He probably needs dozens of these factories, not just one, to really be able to manufacture these type of cars at scale and the kind of cost people want to pay for them.
Clint, do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that this is why Tesla's doing this, or do you see it a little differently?
Yeah, I think partnerships are going to be a big thing for Tesla in this area. And Musk said so himself in a conference call with journalists yesterday. He's talking to BMW already about charging stations. I mean, really, I think this is a lot of what this has to do with is standardizing infrastructure so that electric cars can work across the country and work parts could be used in across platforms and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eric Blatberg, you know, why do you need to make a big announcement like this and make a big deal out of this? He removed the patents that used to be framed and hung in the lobby, I guess, of their headquarters. And if this is all about partnerships, isn't licensing of patents just part of a normal partnership? Why do you have to sort of imply that you're throwing this open and doing something radically different?
Well, there's a couple of things at play here. There's the publicity factor. And I mean, Tesla already has a stellar reputation, but this only improves it. But it's really an open invitation for auto manufacturers to approach Tesla and we should be clear, they're reserving their right to countersue. They said they wouldn't initiate lawsuits against anyone who in good faith uses these patents. But the big difference between, say, like the technology industry and the automotive industry, obviously there's some crossover here. If you make a piece of software and want to license that around, that takes enormous bandwidth, but there's only a limited amount of auto manufacturers that can really come and sit down with Tesla and do something substantial with this. So Tesla really does, even though it's not a giant auto manufacturer itself, it does have the bandwidth to sit down with those companies. But I think at the end of the day, Musk is a very idealistic guy, and he would rather have a smaller slice of the pie in a growing industry than dominate a smaller electric vehicle industry.
Well, is that, again, and this is open to anybody, you know, is that part of the equation here? He's saying, okay, let's look at it from a business perspective. I can sit here all day and build Tesla vehicles and not share my patents, or I can do something like this. I can work with other major brands, and now I'll get a piece of the action with everybody. You know, that's the old Bill Gates scenario. You know, I mean, there was a, you know, the old statement that it was far more lucrative to be in software than to be in hardware, because people had to license your stuff and you only had to make one thing. Hardware, you're making new things every year. Not that he's stopping that, but is there a compelling argument to be made here that from a business perspective, this is the smart move for Tesla, as Elon realizes maybe we can't compete as well as we might like against some of these much larger manufacturers?
Clint Finley, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the case, largely because as Musk points out himself, the big car companies aren't really pushing electric vehicles very heavily at this point. So I'm not sure where that comes into play. Something else I did want to mention, though, from the business standpoint that he's pointed out, is that it could also be really good for recruiting engineers. And that's certainly been the case in software. But you know, no one's really been doing that sort of thing in automotive, trying to use open source as a recruiting tool.
I think that, you know, I suspect that a lot of this, what's driving this is the fact that Elon Musk realizes that his biggest barrier is that the system, the general political and economic system, is kind of rigged against an innovator like this in an industry where there's so many powerful vested interests, the oil companies, the existing car companies, and so on. And by getting more buy-in by other car companies, he might sort of turn the ship in his direction. Now, Jason Perlow, we've been talking about patents and licensing patents and sharing patents and partnerships around patents and that sort of thing. What are these patents? What is the intellectual property that Elon Musk and Tesla have that would be valuable to another car company?
Right. So there are approximately 200 patents which Tesla has. These are effectively methods for doing various types of things. They're not actually reference designs for the Tesla powertrain, how to build that car per se. They're things like, you know, their specific electrolyte processes and such for the type of batteries that go into the cars that are unique to Tesla, and why that car has such a fine range compared to, you know, the competing electric vehicles on the market. So there's a lot of those type of things that I think that if they were to be licensed or to have standards agreed upon with the larger companies out there, not necessarily Detroit, perhaps companies like Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Volkswagen, you know, the Kias and the Hyundais of the world, those type of things, that potentially you have the ability to create an entire industry. Right now, the Tesla car has a, you know, global demand for about 35,000 units a year globally. Just to put that in perspective, BMW, Mercedes, and Lexus's entire car sales in the United States in 2012 was about 800,000 units. So it's one thing for Tesla to continue on as a boutique car maker, but if they really want to grow the industry per se, which I think that's what Elon Musk wants to do, they need to start producing stuff at much larger scale. And to do that, that requires partnerships. That requires a lot of investments in manufacturing, in infrastructure, and all sorts of other businesses that need to be created to create an entire community for an industry. There are a lot of side industries, side businesses, and things that would have to be created in order to support something of that size.
Jason Perlow, do you think there's any chance that he'll be willing to share some of the patents with non-car makers? I know that there are a lot of patents that Tesla has around batteries, battery manufacturing, factory manufacturing, that would be of use to non-car makers. Do you think there's any chance of that?
Well, I know that he had a very long business meeting with Apple. And as we all know, Apple probably wants to increase the battery life of their smartphones, as probably does Samsung and a few others. You know, there are various different applications, I'm sure, that can come out of such a thing. So, yes, I'm sure that's the case. Battery efficiency and power efficiency and sustainable energy is obviously one of his goals, right?
And, of course, Steve Jobs, the late Apple founder Steve Jobs, said that one of his dreams was to build an Apple iCar, I guess. And I had written a column maybe a year and a half ago, suggesting that Apple should buy Tesla. I know other people have suggested that as well. They could do that with some of the lunch money sitting around in the cushions there. But I think that Apple buying Tesla is probably about as likely as me buying a Tesla sometime within the next 6 months. Well, Jason Perlow, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today.
Thank you.
All right, you can find Jason Perlow at ZDNet.com and on Twitter at JPerlow. And Clint Finley, I want to thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Clint's at ClintFinley.com and also at Clintron with a K.
Ooh, I like that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. And Eric Blatberg, thank you as well. Thanks for coming on Tech News today.
Thanks for having me.
Eric's at VentureBeat.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Eric Blatberg. Well, Don, looks the negotiator, William Shatner, has negotiated quite a deal for Priceline. What's going on?
Yeah. This is quite a deal. So Priceline has agreed to acquire OpenTable. That's the restaurant reservation service for $2.6 billion. Priceline says that it's going to use all of that infrastructure with OpenTable to expand internationally, and it believes it's a good deal. You know, Mike, you've been asking – you're the one who asks all the questions in the show. I need to ask you a question. I need to ask you, is OpenTable really worth $2.6 billion?
I don't think it's worth $200 million. It doesn't seem even remotely within the ballpark. I think that some of the acquisitions Facebook has been making lately and the prices they've been paying has completely warped and twisted the sense of how much companies are and should be worth, especially services like this. I mean, OpenTable, I think, has one thing going for it, which is that it's probably the leading contender for the future of Siri, Google Now, and Cortana interfaces that they are, mm-hmm. they need to use services in order to acquire the what they call agency, going out and doing things. One of the things you can do is make restaurant reservations. Siri, of course, supported OpenTable well before Apple bought it, when it was just a little app on the iOS platform. They dropped OpenTable support. I think they brought it back. I'm not sure if it's back in right now. But OpenTable has been preparing themselves for many years to be plugged into a sort of a virtual reservation system, a virtual assistant kind of scenario. So, you know, that they've got that going for them. But how do you, I mean, just think about the recouping of that money. How do you make so many restaurant reservations to pay off a $2.6 billion
right
bill?
So let's think about this, you know, put a little context to it. So OpenTable does about 15 million reservations every month. Okay, they're able to seat 15 million diners every month. They have about 31,000 restaurants in their network. I wrote about this earlier today on CNET. They are essentially making a very small profit. Let's say, I think it was somewhere in the range of $30 million a year. That was their annual profit, to put that into perspective. And their share price was around $70 a share at the close of yesterday. This is a 46% premium on that share price. This is on a company that's valued nowhere near $2.6 billion. I think you're right in saying that OpenTable is more an add-on feature than a standalone feature. I just don't see how it's possible that Priceline is ever going to get this money back. I think that these guys have lost their minds.
Yeah.
I think they've lost their minds. Well, they're on an acquisition spree. They bought digital marketing firm, what's it called, Boutique, earlier this week.
Yep.
They didn't announce the amount of that. I think these guys just say, look, we are the biggest player in this travel market, online travel market. They own Kayak. They own, obviously, Priceline. They own Booking.com, a bunch of other places. And they're saying, look, we don't really care. We have the money. Our share price is skyrocketing. It's over $1,000 a share. And we're making billions of dollars. We don't care. This is nothing to us.
Here's a theory for you that might explain this. Priceline wants to become kind of the Google of anything having to do with vacations, hotels, restaurants, nightlife, you name it. They want to be the one single place where almost everybody goes to get all of those things done. So, you know, they started out with hotel reservations, that sort of thing. They want to be the concierge. They want to be everything related to, you know, I guess you could call it leisure time, right? What's that worth? That's worth, you know, it's priceless, essentially. Right. If they can achieve that. And what's standing in their way? I think Priceline is one of those big companies, and it's not a big company, but in the area of restaurant reservations, it's the company, right, that's standing in their way of becoming that super dominant player. So this isn't about direct recouping of money for the price they paid for this product. This is about acquiring a property and taking it out as a competitor that will enable them to sort of leverage all of the different things that they have into becoming the super dominant player in everything having to do with leisure. And if they can achieve that, then it's definitely worth it, because that's the sort of the golden goose that will keep on laying eggs. So, you know, I think it probably makes more sense if they can achieve their goal of becoming the Google of leisure time.
Yeah, well, I think, but the problem is when these guys, and I agree, I think you're right, Mike. I think that they really do want to go there. They want to become that. But the problem is OpenTable is not going to be the last acquisition to make that happen. There are going to be several more. And at what point do the investors in this company, who have been buying up these shares left and right over the last several years, when are they going to say, look, enough's enough. We want to see some return on that investment. That's going to happen eventually. You know, yep. We're in a world now in this tech space where business and shareholders matter greatly. And I think that could come into play here. But could Priceline become the Google of leisure? I don't know. I guess it'll be interesting to see. There's a lot of competition out there. There's a lot of regulation out there, we know, in the EU and in the US even. And so I wonder where we'll go from here. But odd acquisition.
Yeah, like you said, there are going to be further acquisitions, so maybe the OpenTable acquisition will help them in their negotiations, as in, accept our price for this company or you may never get another restaurant reservation again, pal. Make them an offer they can't refuse.
Yeah.
Well, Google plans to launch a new service called Google Fit. The service will collect and aggregate data from quantified self gadgets and health and fitness apps, according to an exclusive by Parmi Olson at Forbes. And Parmi joins us now to tell us about her exclusive. Welcome, Parmi.
Hi, thank you.
All right, can you tell us more about Google Fit? What is it exactly?
So what we've been hearing is that Google's going to be announcing a new service at its developers conference at the end of this month or later this month. And it's going to be really similar to what Apple has already announced at its own developers conference last week. Apple's service is called HealthKit. And this is basically a platform that aggregates data that you are collecting from different wearable devices and different apps that you use to track your health and your fitness. And the idea is that this is going to be a platform, we understand, that aggregates and helps collect all that data in one place.
So is this going to work cross-platform, I guess, is the question. I mean, Apple's iWatch is supposed to be coming. Microsoft is reportedly working on a smartwatch. Is this going to work with all platforms?
The Microsoft smartwatch is going to be cross-platform. That's one of the things that we found out about that story. As far as this, it's not clear to me if it's going to be cross-platform, but my guess is that it would only work on Android, that this is kind of an Android play to try and expand the Android ecosystem. In the same way that HealthKit is probably only going to work sort of within the iOS ecosystem. I don't know if it's going to be cross-platform or not. It's a good question.
Now, it's clear that the competition is likely to be Apple with its health kit, and also Samsung recently announced a SAMI platform,
right,
and some, you know, some APIs and things like that around that. Yeah. I get the feeling that Apple's health kit is going to be more consumer-facing about your personal health, and that the Samsung platform is going to be kind of healthcare and hospital-facing. Where do you think that this Google Fit product or service will fit into that?
Again, I don't know. I haven't been able to get more details on that. I would guess it's probably going to be more consumer facing. I mean, the interesting thing about HealthKit was that when Apple announced that, they also talked about the partnership with the Mayo Clinic, and the fact that there could be a feature where it could detect if your blood pressure had kind of gone out of whack, and it could actually notify your doctor, which is pretty amazing. So that actually sounds like they're veering towards the medical side of things. I'm guessing that Google, kind of knowing that they have this, people know that it's an advertising company, and people are going to be wary about initially Google having access to their health data and being served relevant ads about diabetes and Viagra and whatever else, that I would guess that this would be very much a consumer-facing play to start with, just to get people comfortable with it.
Mm. So Parmi, you know, I'm wondering here with Google in itself, how are things changing at Google? We have the Google acquiring Nest, and mm-hmm. Google has said, look, we're not going to serve ads. There was a letter from the SEC that it wrote to the SEC in December saying, you know, the Internet of Things is what it is. Mobile devices are out there. We shouldn't have to break down advertising by device because everything connects to the Internet. Now there's this move. And then, like you said, there are going to be questions about ads. Is Google, in your opinion, moving away from the ad model and more to getting its grips into a bunch of different things and then figuring out the business model after that?
It could be. I mean, it's funny how when Google first bought Nest, people were joking about how you could be served AdWords. You'd see AdWords Google advertisements on your thermostat. But I would guess that all these different kind of data points within the home, these smart devices, just become sensors or data points that Google can use to, or Google or anyone else can use to learn more about you. I can't see, I think it'd be really hard to move away from that advertising business model. It's just worked so well for Google. And I'm guessing that, you know, the kind of inclusion of all these different smart devices in the Google ecosystem only serve as a way for Google to learn more about us, so that whenever we use search or whenever we use Android, the ads just can become more targeted and more relevant to us and more effective.
So the next frontier is really data. I mean, that's really what you're saying and what we're hearing. I mean, HP, when it announced the machine, it was 2 days ago, you know, they said, look, you know, you could potentially go to the doctor and he'll put in your information. And then next thing you know, it'll spit out what we need to do, and it'll totally fix healthcare. It'll fix this. Mm-hmm. It'll fix that. But ultimately, it's about taking your data, crunching it, analyzing it, and figuring out how to monetize it. And I think maybe that's what you're saying here.
I think so. Purely speculating. And when you think about something like health data and medical data, I mean, I was speaking to someone in the industry yesterday about this, and he was saying that the search term diabetes is incredibly expensive. If you want to like sell ads or buy ad space or buy that search term through the Google dynamic pricing system, like all the big pharmaceutical companies have bought up that word. And so this is like a very profitable and lucrative form of advertising when it comes to medicine and health data. So I think this is something that could be worth a lot to Google, but of course they have to tread really, really carefully because of the huge privacy concerns around that as well.
Well, Parmi Olsen, you said in your report that this is likely to be announced at Google I.O. Jason and I are going to be there, and we'll be watching this very carefully. Great scoop, and I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Parmi.
All right, you can find Parmi Olsen at Forbes.com and also on Twitter at Parmi. Well, Don, it looks like Microsoft has figured out a great way to get you to turn on your Xbox.
So, this is a fascinating one to me. I just love this one. Microsoft has unveiled a new commercial promoting its Kinectless bundle with Aaron Paul, the former co-star of Breaking Bad. And at the beginning of that commercial, he says, Xbox on. Now, okay, we all know that with the Kinect, if you say Xbox on, the console turns on and away we go. Well, the problem is people are reporting around the web that when they play the commercial with the Kinect by their television and obviously the Xbox One right there with it, their Xboxes are turning on. So Microsoft hasn't commented at all on this. Microsoft isn't saying a word. And so now I'm questioning, and I want to ask you, Mike, and Jason and whomever, the people in the chat, let's just ask the world. Is something happening here where Microsoft is going, hey, you know what would be really cool? If we created this commercial where we have Xbox on and then the people who watch it, their Xboxes turn on while they're watching the commercial. We're able to jump through the screen and get them to use their Xbox.
Well, here's another question. I want to ask everybody watching this or listening to this whether your Xbox One turned on when Don Reisinger said the command Xbox on.
All right, here, let's do it. Hold on. Let's do it. Here we go. Xbox on. Did it turn on? Let us know.
TNT at twit.tv.
That's right.
Yeah,
let
exactly.
us know. And so, yeah.
And then hashtag Don Reisinger Xbox on TNT Twit TV.
They say that there's nothing accidental in advertising, and I'd be shocked to hear that Microsoft didn't think of this. And so I think it's could be in the realm of a publicity stunt, because here we are talking about it, giving free mind share to the concept that Microsoft's Xbox turns on with a voice command. So, you know, it's kind of an unexpected thing that they wouldn't talk about this. They should be bragging about this. Yeah, it's a publicity stunt, and just be thankful that that the actor didn't use the B word. I don't think in Breaking Bad he ever spoke without using the B word.
Yeah,
true.
In the plural, collective, et cetera. It's a fascinating marketing ploy, if in fact that's what it is.
And not only that, but the best part about it is, so this is a commercial showing off the great features of the Kinect, which quite frankly, the Kinect works somewhat well. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say it's perfect. I'm not going to say it's awful, but I think it works. When you give it voice commands, it works pretty well. But the best part about it is at the end of this commercial, and this is what is the most shocking, well, the second most shocking, is they're promoting the new $400 Kinectless bundle. So you're showing off all these features, and when people buy that Kinectless bundle for $400, they say, oh, that's a great deal. Okay, I'll take it. They get home, and they start saying Xbox on, and they wonder, why the hell is this thing working? Now, those of us in the tech community know why, that you need a Kinect, but there are people that are watching that commercial that don't follow this stuff closely and don't know that. So it's an odd thing. I almost wonder if they recorded it before they decided to launch the bundle, the Kinectless bundle. I don't know what happened here, but again, it's Microsoft taking two steps forward and one step back with all of its advertising, with everything related to the Xbox. From everything it's announced with this Xbox, it said, hey, you need this, you need that. No, you don't, after people speak out against it. It's just a fascinating saga. I think someone could write a book about the Xbox One and how Microsoft is handling this whole thing.
Go for it, man.
I can't write that well.
PDX.
And one other thing. This is the best thing that's happened all week for Microsoft. That E3 press conference was abysmal, and it didn't talk at all about the future of the Xbox, really, and didn't even talk about the Kinect, hardly. It was just games, games, games. Sony blew them out of the water. This is the best thing that's happened all week for Microsoft and the Xbox.
Yeah, and you're in trouble when Sony blows you out of the water. Someone in the chat room asked also, why can't you change the command that sort of initiates the voice thing in either Microsoft or the Sony product? And that's a good question. The probable answer is that they can assure a lot more reliability when they can control what the phrase is, because they can kind of hardwire that in. But it's an interesting story, Don, and we'll see if we get any emails saying that we were able to turn on people's Xboxes.
I hope so.
All right, well, 9 to 5 Max Mark Gurman posted a really interesting column yesterday pointing out a long list of features in iOS 8 that appear to lay the groundwork for an Apple smartwatch. It was a fascinating piece, and Mark Gurman joins us to talk about his column. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going great. Thank you. So what are some of the new items in iOS 8 that lend themselves to the iWatch treatment?
Right. So if you look at all the new features in iOS 8 that are for the iPhone and iPad, you know, they're good. They add some great stuff, but it's kind of all like scattershot. It's kind of like all over the place. But if you look at it in the context of what operating system will the iWatch run when it launches this fall, it's starting to make sense. There's the feature where you put the phone up to your face and you can send a quick voice memo shot over messages to quickly add pictures and videos. A new keyboard that doesn't require all the characters, the new QuickType feature. Notification center with the new widget apps, extensions, all sorts of stuff. It really makes more sense in the context of something that you wear on a wrist, being able to quickly access functions on a smaller display.
You also mentioned HealthKit is another area where there could be some integration with an iWatch. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So in January, I ran a story that Apple was working on a new health app. At the time, they were calling it HealthBook. It's the same thing that they announced last week at WWDC. And basically, it basically aggregates all the health data from various applications and various devices. But where it will truly make a lot of noise in the industry is when it's connected to the Apple hardware. Because, you know, Apple, they pride themselves on the integration of software, hardware, and services. And this is going to basically be that trio in the health world. So I think it's going to be a really big deal, especially when combined with the watch.
So, Mark, are you convinced that Apple is planning an iWatch? I know we've heard reports that it's actually going to be a sensor-based smart band. Some say nothing's coming out related to that this year. Are you convinced, based on what you know, and obviously you've been following Apple very closely, do you think for sure that there's going to be an iWatch this year?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that they're going to do the watch later this year. It's to be seen which sensors it has this year. I believe that there's going to be a long list of sensors on the roadmap, and it will take at least 5-10 years to implement them all. But I think we'll see a watch that at least has some functions of a pedometer, perhaps a glucose reader, and some other important health functionality by the end of this year or early next year.
You mentioned some other – go ahead, Don.
No, I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say – now, I mean, the next question then, I guess, is will we see a squared-off iWatch or around iWatch? Because, you know, with Android Wear, with Motorola showing off and things like that, the Moto 360, I think it is, right? We have a round operating system, which is something we don't see, you know, and it takes some serious software modification to make that happen.
Right.
Do you think Apple is going to make that happen, go with a rounded iWatch, or is it going to be a squared off iWatch? They don't have to worry about all that.
I mean, this takes us back to the form over function or function over form. And I think Apple always strikes a nice balance. With these sensors, the whole trick is to get them as close as possible to wrap around the veins on the wrist. So if Apple needs to wrap the watch as a circular band around the arm versus a circle that sits on top of the arm, they're going to have to do that. They're not going to be able to get the sensors working properly if they went the Moto 360 route.
Interesting. Okay. That's a really interesting point I haven't heard made besides you making it. Now, you there were a couple of other features that you said lend themselves to an iWatch. One of them is the instant hotspot feature, which was presented as something that lets the iPhone know that, you know, the iPhone and a MacBook, for example, know that they're near each other. And you suggested that it would let the iWatch know that there's an iPhone nearby, but it could also connect or do the same thing that an iPhone does to a MacBook, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But the real magic is going to be when connected to the iWatch. You'll have the phone in your pocket or in your purse or in your bag or whatnot. And the watch will automatically be able to get an internet connection from the phone. And that will open the door for all of its functionality. Basically, you know, Apple's a hardware company at heart, and they're going for their margins. So this is going to be a play on an iPhone accessory. So they're going to want lots of iPhone users to buy it. So they're going to make it as easy as possible for it to be heavily connected to the iPhone. And these tricks like continuity and handoff and instant hotspot are going to make that happen.
You also mentioned the lightning-based headphones could be connected directly into the watch, and I have to think that they're going to do something like that simply because when their iPod Nano started being used as a wristwatch, and of course Steve Jobs suggested when he rolled it out that that could happen, and then Apple supported that with wristbands sold in the stores and so on. I've got to think that the iPod functionality is going to be built into this watch.
Right. So our Jordan Kahn at 95 Mac, he broke the story that Apple is working on a new lightning standard that allows third-party manufacturers, and I guess Apple as well, to create headphones that can plug into iOS devices via the lightning connector. So what that means is that Apple could sell devices without 30-pin standard headphone jacks that could still connect to headphones. And the iWatch is going to be this super thin, super small device that wraps around a wrist. So perhaps they're not going to have room for a 30-pin headphone jack. And the Lightning connectors, their charging standard and their computer syncing standard. So it's very likely that the watch will have a Lightning connector. So what if they can eliminate the headphone jack and just stick everything through Lightning? I don't think they're going to get rid of the 30-pin jack on the iPod or the iPad or the iPhone this year. But it wouldn't be shocking at all that this move is really influenced by the iWatch's size.
That's an interesting idea, and I think that you've really nailed it. That's the kind of thing I would think Apple would do, completely reinvent how this thing works in order to get a jack down to one jack on an iWatch. Mark Gurman, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. Once again, great story. I really enjoyed reading it and wish I had written it, by the way.
I'll see you soon.
All right. See you soon, Mark. You can find Mark Gurman's work, of course, at 9to5Mac.com and on Twitter at Mark Gurman. Yum. Well, Don, it looks like there's going to be a new auction coming up. What are they selling?
Yeah, well, look, this is another fact. Today is like one of the best news days. It's easily one of the best news days in a long time. The U.S. Marshals have announced that they are going to start bidding or auctioning off about 30,000 bitcoins taken from the Silk Road. So as we know, the U.S. government took down Silk Road, which is an underground black web market where things like drugs were sold and other bad things were on there.
They're going to auction off the drugs too, or?
Probably not. I think they're just shipping some to your house, Mike. That's what I heard. That was the word on the street.
I think they already did, but I don't remember because I took too many drugs.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Something like that. No. So, Mike does not do drugs, folks.
That's
right. That was just a joke.
And you kids at home, stay in school.
Yeah, stay in school. Yep. Go to college. So, the deal is, this could be extremely lucrative for the U.S. government, but it's kind of funny because when they went into Silk Road, they took all kinds of bitcoins because that was the currency being used. So, it would be, basically keep all the transactions anonymous. And they're saying, well, why should we hold on to it? Let's just put it out to bid and see what happens. Now, in order to qualify for this, you need to put up $200,000 in a wire transfer in a U.S. bank. So, Mike, you're the only guy here who can do that, so we're going to expect you to do that.
Yeah, I'm going to get right on it.
Yeah, so you need to do that first, and then the bid is being held at the end of the month. But what an interesting thing. I mean, Mike, what do you think about this? Do you think a lot of people are going to move in on this?
No. It's a ridiculous scenario because what's the pricing? This is money. It's like auctioning dollars. What's the fair price for a dollar? It's a dollar, and if you're going to I give you a dollar and you give me back a dollar, then why would you do it? And who's going to bid higher than its monetary value unless people just want to get in on this as a speculative thing? But I just the whole process of, ponying up all this money and then getting into this auction where you're essentially buying currency just sounds like the dumbest thing. I can see some company throwing the money away to get some sort of publicity stunt and get in the news for buying this stuff. But it's a bizarre thing to auction off Bitcoin. I think they should just, the U.S. Marshals should donate it to their firefighter fund or something like that.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing. I do think that there's some speculation going on here. It's saying, okay, right now it's trading at about $600 or so dollars per dollar. So this would be an $18 million offering. There are some people who think it'll go back up to 1,000 where it was before the Mt. Gox thing went down. So I don't know, maybe, but I have a prediction. I'm putting it out here right now.
Okay.
The Winklevoss twins come out of nowhere who, they've invested very, very heavily in Bitcoin, and they're going to buy up this whole thing in one fell swoop. The Winklevoss twins.
You heard it here first, folks. The Winklevi. We'll be back in the news buying this thing. Yeah. Well,
they're tired of getting screwed, Mike. First it was Facebook, but they're not going to let it happen again with Bitcoin, and this is what's going to happen. They're going to take all the Bitcoins, and they're going to go home with them.
Well, it's an interesting prediction, and I wouldn't put it past them. The Winklevi are a shameless pair of knuckleheads, so we'll see what happens there. Well, in other news, Don Reisinger. The restaurant chain P.F. Chang's was hacked recently and customer credit card was stolen, blah, blah, blah. Happens all the time. But the company implemented a hack-proof method of processing credit cards. They're using swipe machines that imprint the data using carbon paper. Yeah, they're using those junk things from the 70s to basically, and you sign it, you know, they bring the thing. Unbelievable. Is this where we're going with all the hack attacks and security nightmares that are happening? We're gonna go back to the past to analog methods for everything?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know what's going on out there. I mean, it's almost like every week you should expect to get a new credit card in the mail from your bank saying, hey, look, you know, we think that there might have been some fraud or some data theft, and therefore we're going to have to give you a new card. I know we did it last week, but that was a different one. I mean, this just doesn't end, and it's really, really, really concerning.
Not to mention the carbon imprint. It doesn't crack down on theft of data, because the credit card, if that ever ends up in the trash, then right. Basically you have hackers hacking the analog world. All they have to do is good old dumpster diving, and they find a pot of gold in a bunch of credit card receipts with full credit card numbers on them.
Yeah, so the next thing is going to be putting tissue paper over our credit cards, taking a number two pencil and just, you know, like going over it like this, and then just saying, hey, can you sign this for me? I mean, this is the most ludicrous thing, but it's the world we live in. The malicious hackers are winning this war very, very easily. And really, these companies are doing nothing to combat it. I mean, they all come out and they say, oh, we're very sorry. We'll give you 1 year of free identity theft protection, and sorry, and we all go back to work. That's what Target did. That's what Sony did. These companies, that there's a script now. I mean, essentially, what all this has done is create a script for these companies to follow, so they can make it go away quickly. And it's really, really sad.
Maybe we should abandon digital currency altogether and just go back to the days when every bank had a giant vault with huge sacks of money in the back. Coins stacked up all over the place, and you know,
that's
you
right.
go there, and yeah, why not? Might as well do that.
Yeah.
I don't think Wall Street would like that, because I don't think they know how to trade anymore unless it's done by computers. Well, that's the tech news today. Don Reisinger, I want to thank you. You are our Friday co-anchor, and I want to thank you.
For now,
and we'll see you again.
Yeah, who knows? After this showing, you're probably going to get rid of me. That's what's going to happen.
not a chance.
I talked about your drug use. I mean, this is just...
it's nice to talk about it. You know, admitting you have a problem is the first step. Don Reisinger, we'll see you next Friday here on Tech News Today.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, you can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT and on YouTube at youtube.com/TechNewsToday. And follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. Subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. That's for you guys who are complaining that I don't mention Reddit enough. And we want to hear from you, of course. Comment on Twitter or Google+ using the hashtag TechNewsToday, and we will find it. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight. That's you tonight, right, Jason?
That's right. All right, I'll be there.
Jason's anchoring tonight, 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. And, of course, you don't want to ever miss that show or this show. And, you know, Mike Elgin signing off. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.